This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, thanks for spending your lunch hour with me. I know that's a real privilege for you to do that. I'm going to talk about a study that was done, that was initiated about 2 years ago. And it was a study that I really felt was important to do on pension liability. And let me go over and show you exactly what the project looked like. Okay, so it was called the Higher Education Pension Reform Project. And the project was conducted by the Center, Study Higher Education here at Berkeley. It was funded by Fidelity, and it was also funded by other sponsors. The University of Arizona provided support, as did Berkeley. The partners in the project, which also included the advisory committee that advised the project, included some of the national associations in D.C. Some of these are familiar, some may not. NACUBO is the Business Officers Association. It's about 2,000 institutions that are members of that, all the way from two-year colleges, private, to major research universities. CUPA is the HR, Professional Association, Human Resources, and it was important to have them in there from the human resource personnel standpoint. AGB is the Association of Governing Boards. And the Governing Boards Association really has all the members of the boards, the chairs of the boards, and they inform the governing boards, the Board of Regents and others, what's happening in higher education. So we needed to have the board involved. NASBO is the National Association of State Budget Officers. These are the state budget officers. And so this was important to get the state perspective in here, and they were also on our advisory committee. NASH is relatively new. That's the National Association of State of System Heads, and it includes all the systems in the country. CSU's a member, UC's a member, University of Missouri, etc. ACUA is the Association of College University Attorneys. I'm picking up the legal part of it because that's a critical part of it. And then CHEA is the accreditors, Council for Higher Education Accreditation. And we had two rating agencies involved in study. One, Moody's decided they wanted to advise us but not be part of the committee. Standard & Poor's decided they would be part of the committee. So we had quite a representative advisory group. And the role of this group was really to look at project design, make recommendations on where things were happening we wanted to look at. And the project objective was pretty clear. It was to highlight best practices and to disseminate information to the higher education community. What we found in the course of looking at states and institutions is sometimes they don't talk to each other and they try to reinvent the wheel. And so the idea was to try to get a national study that would inform people what was going on. There were three phases of what we call HEPR. One was the environmental scan. We looked at all the things that were happening, all the studies that had been done, what was happening in states, to try to identify where we wanted to go further. The survey phase was using our advisory committee members and their organizations to do surveys, and we decided we wanted to do surveys by segment rather than a large survey. So we surveyed the HR professionals. CUPA has an annual survey that they do on salaries and benefits, benefits every 2 years, and so we added several questions to their annual survey and got that back. NASH, we looked at states in which things were happening, Louisiana, Illinois, Hawaii, and identified 11 states to go take a look at, and we surveyed those folks as well. AGB, that was the last survey, and that was the governing board members. That survey went out to chairs of boards and chairs of finance committees. Response on that survey was a little bit less than we'd hoped because the private universities have dealt with this problem in the past. They really have done that. Publics hadn't, and the public responses were pretty voices of concern about what was going to happen, particularly with the new reporting requirements required by the accounting organization called GASB, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, and I'll go to that in a minute. The final phase was a series of visits. We did this about this time last year. We went to three states, Michigan, Utah, and Rhode Island. These states were selected because they had done reform, and they had done it long enough to see what was happening, what had changed, what were the legal battles they were going through. We looked at three public university systems, University of California, University of Missouri, which is a system very similar, California State University system, which is part of the CalPERS. Its retirement program is a state retirement program. We looked at two public universities, Virginia Tech, and the University of Arizona. Both these schools, faculty and management, have an option of going with a defined contribution program. Staff are really bound by the state retirement system, as they are in CalPERS. We looked through two private universities, Emory, which consists of Emory University and Emory Health, a large private in Atlanta, and Bryant University, a small liberal arts school in Rhode Island. So we were trying to get a kind of a good cross-mixture of what was happening. Now, why is it a critical issue for our education? This is from Moody's Investor Services. This looks at the percent of revenue that's associated with the pension liability. So pension liability in Illinois is 318% of the total revenue that the state generates, a huge problem. Connecticut, 243, Kentucky, 211, Hawaii, 199, and Louisiana, 183. A number of these states have gone through pension reforms last year. This is an interesting study by the Pew Center for the States, and it was updated recently, but it didn't really change much. What is interesting about this is those states that are in blue are at 80% of the liabilities funded. That's sort of the gold standard. You want to be at least 80% funded. Some of these other states are below that. So Maryland, 64. Here's Illinois at 45. And so there's quite a gap, but the fact that there's only a few states out of the 50 that are actually well-funded or at 80% or more is of concern. The other area that is related to this is health benefits. And in that picture, it's even worse. There's only a few states that fully fund retiree health benefits. Now, in our state, California, a report last year by the California Legislative Analyst Office looked at the liabilities, the unfunded liabilities that require further attention. There's about 200 billion of these unfunded liabilities, but the majority relate to pension programs, with the California State Teacher Retirement System leading the pack, 73 billion. Retiree for state, 64, UC 13.8, UC Retiree Health 12.5, and then the judges retirement system. Put this in a context, the CalSTRS pension liability, if it was fully funded, would require the appropriations for both the CSU system and the UC system for 30 years to fully fund this. So it's a huge problem. Also, the other factor beyond liability is the life expectancy of retirees. So this is out of the Wall Street Journal as of, I think, last year, and it shows the life expectancy of a female-male population. Another interesting statistic is that 11,000 people a day for the next 15 years will turn 65. So it's a growing problem, and it's a problem that we saw not only in the United States but also in other countries, New Zealand, United Kingdom, and elsewhere, where they've tried to address this on a national level. So in addition to the liability issue, colleges and universities are required to report their financial information under standards developed by two bodies. For the private universities, it's the Financial Accounting Standards Board. So Stanford would be FASB, Cornell would be FASB, but the public universities, the University of California, are under what's called the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. And the Governmental Accounting Standard Boards dictates what are in financial statements. And why this is important is under GASB 67 and 68, it deals with pensions. 67 relates to the pension system itself, and 68 relates to individual institutions' liability. What's important about this is this 68 will require that public universities disclose their pension liabilities on their financial statements. Now, privates have always had to do this, but publics haven't, because if you're part of the state retirement system, part of the University of California retirement system, it was handled system-wide. This disclosure would put it on your books. And what it'll do, it'll turn a number of the financial statements negative. So in Arizona, the pension liability, University of Arizona, $500 million. The liability, University of California, equally significant. Also, when this happens, it'll have an effect on ratings. So ratings are important, because that's how you sell bonds. You want the best rating possible to get the best rate possible. So even though we had Moody's and Standard & Poor's, the rating agencies involved, they're still waiting to see what happens in terms of how this will affect the bottom line. And then it'll also affect how public universities address the pension liability issue. When it was not on your books, it was at the state level, it became a state problem. On your books, a lot of states are concerned about the fact that it becomes an institution's liability that they have to address. And so if they have to address it, it means you're going to fund something less in order to meet that liability. So the reporting requirement in addition to liability is significant. The third area is the populations that are involved. And this is important because how you deal with pension reform relates to how you deal with these populations. So there are retirees, people that have left service, active employees, people that are currently in the system, and new hires. It's obviously easier to deal with new hires than it is to deal with either one of the other two, though pension reform involves dealing with all three groups. Providers, you've got standalone institutions. The private schools, for example, would fall in that category. Public university systems that have their own retirement system, like California, Missouri, and states, which would have a state retirement system. So the fourth area is the type of benefits involved. Defined benefit programs are really the pension program. Your employer puts so much in, you may have to contribute so much in. At the end, you've got a defined benefit. The liability is on the pension program, not on the individual. Defined contribution is exactly reverse. It means that individuals and employers put money in, and depending on how those funds do, depends on what your retirement benefit is, what you're going to have at the end. Hybrid, which is the pattern we saw more and more, was a combination of both the benefit program, defined benefit, and defined contribution. So a lot of schools are moving in that direction to limit their liability, the employer's liability, but it also means that one of the advantages to a defined contribution program is portable. So if you leave the university, it goes with you. Defined benefit doesn't. So when I left the university, my defined benefit programs was here. I moved into a defined contribution program or another defined benefit program. So the portability is a big factor. Cash match is a kind of a small program we added in Virginia where you put so much in and the state matches you. That's one program. And then the common types of programs, 403B, most common within defined benefit programs, within public universities, 457, common again within universities. These are individual. They can be either institutional or individual programs. So under the tax code in the United States, you can actually, as an individual, put money into a 403B or a 457, as well as what your employer does. It's a way of expanding your benefit portfolio. 401Ks are more common among the private sector, 401As, and then there are other types. So this just repeats the difference between the two. But these are the primary ones. The defined benefit program, almost 89% of the publics have defined benefit. The privates are all defined, mostly defined contribution. If they had defined benefits, like University of Miami, they froze those and backed out of those systems as quickly as they could. But the publics are still very much involved in defined benefit, particularly if you're in a state retirement system. We thought it would be important to kind of look at them. This comes out of the University of California Office of the President report, but it looks at the employer-employee contribution in the defined benefit plan, the pension plan, and it showed the current rates, employer at July 13th, employer went up July 13th. It's still going up. And what you'll notice here is that the employer is greater than the employee share. Frequently, and you'll see this later on, they're almost identical. But in this case, the choice was to increase employer and increase employee, but increase employer more. CalPERS is a state system. Larger contribution from the employer, 5% from the employee, and it stayed that way for some time. In 91, University of California stopped employee contributions, and it stopped until the mid-2000s. CSU continued that. And the consequence of this was that it resulted in an unfunded liability increasing at UC, but it also involved that the state would not contribute into those programs. So at CSU, the employee contributed, the employer contributed, the state contributed. So for the period, the state said, if employees aren't going to contribute, we're not going to contribute. Now that we've started contributions again, the state this year agreed to put in the state share, the state share of the contribution. The CalPERS system varies by agency and by type of employee, whether you're public safety or whatever. And so it's very much a very traditional state retirement system. Stanford does not offer a defined benefit program, a pension program. It is all defined contribution, employer, it's 1 to 5% based on service, and 1.5% to 5% match on employee contributions. You see this a lot in defined contribution programs, especially the hybrid programs, where they move from defined benefit. They create not only a contribution piece, but also a match, so that it incentivizes employees to put money into the program. And they have a voluntary employee program. SUNY, large public system, looks a lot like CalPERS, 18.9. 3% is the employee. Both SUNY, Illinois, and Virginia have this unique system where if you're a faculty or management, you can choose defined contribution. That's true in Rhode Island as well. That's not true here in California. At the University of California Retirement Program, you're in the program. You're in the CSU program. You're in the program. But in these states, faculty and management can choose to go defined contribution. And so in that plan, the employer puts in 8 to 10%, and the employee puts in 3. Virginia, 8.9, employee, 5 for the... Michigan does not offer, it's a public, but doesn't offer a defined benefit program. They decided 20 years ago, along with Michigan State and Central Michigan, to get out of the state system. And what they went to was a defined contribution system where it was 10% for the employer and 5% for the employee. This is also true in Utah. They do the same thing. Harvard, no defined benefit there. They are 5 to 15% based on age and pay, and then they have the voluntary program as well. So there's quite an interesting gap between private universities who've chosen largely defined contribution and the publics who have chosen to stay with defined benefit. At least the University of California has. University of Missouri looked at its portfolio after the Great Recession and said, we're 70% funded. We were 100% before the recession. We need to look at an option. And so both the universities, Missouri system and California, had a committee, faculty committee, that came together and decided where they wanted to go. At UC, they chose defined benefit. At Missouri, they chose a hybrid. And so the hybrid system at Missouri is employees put in 1% and the employer puts in 10%. But it's in those that were in the old defined benefit program stay in it, but all new hires and people will move to the hybrid program. So what we've found in looking at both institutions and states was a number of strategies. The first would be you freeze the defined benefit plan and transition to a defined contribution plan. There's concerns about that because how soon can you transition? And the rating agencies have really been pretty strict on the fact that you should really deal with this in a couple of years. Now, this has been loosened up a little bit, but it is a concern if you do that. You increase the employer and employee contributions. That's happened across the country. It certainly happened within UC. You offer a hybrid defined benefit program. University of Missouri did that. Virginia Tech, its state retirement program, did that. You introduce modifications, structural modifications. And though these may seem slight, they have a real difference in terms of active employees when they retire. You change your retirement age from 60 to 62 to 66. That happened in Rhode Island. Or you tie it to the Social Security age. You eliminate COLAs for retirees. Now, the situation with COLAs, cost of living allowances, a lot of folks assume those were automatic. They're not automatic. And so in Rhode Island, there was quite a legal battle over the fact that COLAs were no longer going to be offered. And their argument was that when you retired, you could choose to have a cost of living allowance, or you could choose for less of a benefit, or you could choose not to. So that's been in the courts for quite some time. It looks like that's going to be something that it will rule in the advantage that you can eliminate COLAs as you can with health benefits. You can reduce those health benefits. You can also change the calculation retirement benefits from the highest 3 to the highest 5. You can change your investment allocation strategies. Prior to the Great Recession, the benchmark was 8% of your pool, of your retirement pool, would be your return on that rate of return. That's not happened. It didn't happen during the Great Recession. And so what people are looking at is moving that downward between 6 and 7%. And even people that are doing that are concerned that that may not be low enough. You can terminate the defined benefit program. But critical to all of this is the education, not only of the people in the program, but also the legislators, the governor, and the general public. That happened in Michigan. It happened in Rhode Island. It happened in Utah. Absolutely essential to tell people that if you just choose to fund your unfunded liability, it means you're going to have fewer school teachers, not as good roads. You have to make those choices. And so in both in Utah and in Michigan, and these changes took several years to happen, they were able to convince people by saying, within a state budget, there are trade-offs. And one trade-off is you can fund your pension liability or you can fund other things. And then the importance of voluntary employee contributions. We saw that internationally. New Zealand's gone to a program where they have a Social Security pension program, but they also have a sort of forced savings program. As you start as an employee, they'll put you in a savings program, and unless you voluntarily opt out, you'll stay there. The idea that they wanted was to have a richer retirement portfolio because their life expectancy in New Zealand was 100 years. You know, we're 91 and 87. They're looking at a much longer life expectancy. Lesson learned, pensioning is a balancing act between the needs of the employer and the needs of the participant, needs of new employees, active employees, and retirees. The big difference between your defined benefit program like UC and defined contribution is the liability issue. With defined benefit, the liability is on the system. A lot of people like that. On defined contribution, the liability is on the individuals, how you invest your funds. But it's portable, so a lot of people like that. Parties need to understand the trade-offs between funding requirements and pension benefits. If you want your pension system to be solid and secure, you may give up certain benefits. You may have to give up certain benefits, or you may have to pay more. And then the communication among all parties is absolutely critical. So you've got the communication on an ongoing basis. The curious thing about public colleges that are part of state retirement systems like CalPERS, Arizona, Virginia, is those pension programs cover all state agencies, public health, General Service Administration, and you're a player in that pool. So you may have certain needs that are really unique to your system, but if the other agencies don't agree with that, prison yards, et cetera, you could end up having really difficulty to try to change that. And I think that with this reporting that's going to happen, this may force that issue more. There's an impact of the transition costs in changing from defined benefit to defined contribution. I mentioned that. What's happening under the accounting standards, one of the little parts that isn't really clearly understood is if you become unfunded, if you were have a system that's totally unfunded and it becomes totally unfunded, your assumptions on revenue change dramatically from, say, 7% to 4.5%. Because the rating agencies are going to look at that and say, we don't think this is very solvent, and it affects your ability to borrow. And then the legal challenges, which are numerous, that you have to understand what those are. And in Rhode Island, it's been the whole issue of not so much the hybrid program so much as the COLA. It's been a big issue. In Illinois, it's an issue about what the state contributes in, lawsuits on that. And every time there's a lawsuit in a state, the other states join in as friends of the court. So these things go on for years and years. So that's my presentation. I'd be glad. The publication itself is richer than this presentation. It includes the case studies for the systems, Cal State, UC, and Missouri, and for the individual institutions. But I'd be glad to answer any questions you might want have on it. Yes?
And so what happened, the question was, why was UC taking money out of the pension system in 91, 92, 93, and as recently as 2002 and 2003 for Cat 1 and Cat 2? And why was the pension system supposed to be so overvalued in the 1990s that we weren't contributing at all? Talking to the actuarials, they said, that's because we smoothed the return over 5 years, and we amortized the liability 1 year at a time in the 1990s. And I said, well, there's no data that shows that makes any sense at all.
Right.
And they said, yes, but that was the industry standard.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is amazing. This is billions of dollars, perhaps trillions. And you say, well, it doesn't make any sense. You have to smooth over at least 25 or 30 years to get 4% over inflation. So inflation is, at the University of California, we assume 7.5% return, but 3.5% inflation. Mm-hmm. They just lowered it to 7 and 3. Mm-hmm. So it's still 4% over inflation.
Right.
And it's continual confusion about looking at the return 6, 7, 8% without assuming what the inflation is. But now they're assuming liability is calculated over 30, amortized over 30 years instead of 1 year. And that seemed to make the difference. Maybe you discussed that and arrived a few minutes late.
Yeah.
Can you discuss this?
Yeah. When we visited the University of California and did the site visit, we looked at that. We looked at all the board documents related to the bonding, because one of the ways they solved, UC solved its problem was internal and external borrowing. External borrowed and an internal borrowed. So all the actuarial assumptions had to change. We looked at that. And when we looked at the state of Utah, the problem was the person who pushed this through, Senator Lundgren, was chair of the retirement committee, and he sat down with the actuarials, and he couldn't make Buffness die of it. He couldn't understand what they were doing. So, and he couldn't explain it to the public because he couldn't understand what was happening. So to make the case for pension reform in Utah, they had to have a better understanding. I think things are normalizing more than they have. I think the issue, I was here in 90, 91, 92, 93, 94, VERP 1, VERP 2, VERP 3. The system was supposedly funded at 139% of its liability. Right now, the UCRP system, according to the new actuarials and centers, about 80%. So they're close to being there. But I think they made decisions on that system that may not have been the right decisions. But remember the time we were dealing with. We were dealing with major budget reductions, significant, in 1991. And the idea was the early retirement programs would free up faculty lines, and it would be, allow us an ability to manage that sort of crisis. But I would agree with you that there needs to be a better understanding of actuarial assumptions, needs to be a better understanding of return on investment. It's not 8%. It's not 7.5%. And the other thing that Missouri did that was really important was they created a stabilization fund. Okay, what this meant was that if they made a budget assumption that so much should go into pension, and they didn't need it that year, they took the difference and put it into a stabilization fund. So when the return on investment wasn't there, instead of automatically changing rates, they could dip into that and have a stable way of dealing with it. But I would agree with you. I think, and that's the big problem that a lot of states and institutions wrestle with, is explaining to the public these assumptions, the actuarial assumptions. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, actually, I would say that explaining to the board and possibly even the regents.
Yes.
Because when probed, and this is coming from the point of view as a person who worked essentially as an application chemist.
Yeah.
And actually looked scientific information on actuarial standards, they didn't make any sense.
Right.
And they said, well, that's the industry standard. That was always their bottom line was, this is the industry standard. We're saying your pension system is hugely overvalued because we're amortizing one liability over 1 year at a time instead of 30 years. That's because they claim that was the law in the 1990s. And we smooth the return over 5 years. And you're making so much return in the 1990s, it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. And you look at the history of the stock market from 1890 and you say, well, you've got to smooth over at least 30 years to get consistent 4% over inflation. And then they say, well, yes, but the industry standard was that we weren't doing that. And it's, as a scientist from another discipline walking into this, you say, well, there's no data that shows what you're doing makes any sense.
Okay.
And they said, yes, that's the industry standard.
Right. So let me just say one response to that. Boards need to get involved. What we saw at Missouri and elsewhere is boards did get involved. The president got involved. The president that came into the University of Missouri was the president at Sprint. He was from the private sector. He wasn't an academic. He was from the private sector. He looked at these trends and he said, these don't make any sense. So they put together a committee, the same way they did at UC, and tried to argue on these, what the actual assumptions were. But boards need to get involved. And so that's why we included AGB as part of our advisory group. What was interesting was when we got responses back on that survey, the public board members, the chairs, very, very concerned about what was happening because they saw the GASB, the reporting standards change, the visibility change, but they need to become engaged, I would agree. Yes.
I have a question in the comments. You said that a couple of public universities, faculty have a choice between a defined benefit. And, so that's a choice they make when they first are employed?
Yes, they've got a limited window, 90 days.
Do you have any information about what choices they make? I mean, I would hazard a guess that they all choose a defined contribution
plan. It depends on the institution. So mostly they do choose defined contribution. A lot of it depends on where you're going to be. If you plan to spend your career at a university, defined benefit might make the most amount of sense. If you view that you're going to be moving from institution to institution, defined contribution makes the most amount of sense. I've got an interesting story. I was at Virginia Tech, as Carol said, for about 5 years. In the mid-90s, they did offer faculty that choice, and a limited number of faculty chose defined contributions. The Virginia retirement system was fairly well-funded, and it had a really nice return on investment. As those faculty got close to the retirement, they tried to opt back into the defined benefit program, and the Virginia retirement system said, sure, but it'll be based on actuarial assumptions. It's going to cost you more to buy back into the system. But in general, in Rhode Island and Arizona and Utah, faculty and management do tend to choose that defined contribution option rather than defined benefit.
Because who would assume that they're going to be able to make a career, particularly as an untenured faculty member, planning to stay for 30 or 40 years? But my comment is that it's been very interesting here at the University of California that the Academic Senate has been firmly supportive of the defined benefit plan, for years and years. I'm not sure that that reflects the opinions of young faculty, but it certainly reflects the stated opinion of the faculty through the Academic Senate.
Well, during this committee proceeding that was done, the committee that was organized at UC, one of the things they did was did a survey of faculty and staff as to why they would choose defined benefit versus defined contribution. And the survey results came back that they really preferred defined benefit because it was a retention issue for faculty and staff. They wanted some stability. They were willing to pay in more to the system to have a defined benefit program. So they did do that survey, and that's what resulted.
Well, certainly, it's definitely a retention issue. I mean, we've been joking about it for years, that at some point in your career, it's very difficult to leave the University of California pension system behind. We'd be sorry to see it go.
No, that's true. And we would sit down with faculty that were thinking about going to Harvard or Yale or Princeton, wherever, and we'd sit down and say, at that time, there's no employee contribution. Look what would happen. You're 50, 55. If you stay here, look at the benefit at the end of that period of time versus what you're going to do. You're going to work harder at Harvard and Yale because you're going to generate more grant and contract activity, so there's more work there, but you're not going to have that kind of security you would have at UC. And I think the model at UC was different for faculty. And that is, when faculty were hired into the University of California, the idea was you're going to stay here. Whereas a place like Harvard, where they get a whole bunch of assistant profs and dump a whole bunch of them, UC was much more looking at allowing people to move up. And that's one of the big pluses of the University of California. Probably another factor in the choice of defined benefit. Other questions? Yes.
Here. Jim?
I actually did serve on that work group in 2010-11, and my recollection
is that all the studies did show that people ended up better with a defined benefit plan, partly because of who was making the investment decisions, that no matter how much you can tell people to buy low and sell high, they do the opposite very frequently when they try to manage their own investments. So there was a good reason for a financial reason for preferring the defined benefit. But the other thing is, I guess, an internal political question, which you were touching on just a moment ago, and that is, if the institution is going to use benefits, including a defined benefit retirement system, as a recruitment and retention device, is it then fair to say, okay, we're going to pay you less, but we've got this nice system? On the other hand, we're not going to take responsibility for the system. It's a defined contribution, so you're taking the risk in addition. You're taking a lower salary, but also the risk. Somehow it seems to me that the top-notch faculty are going to see right through that, and that I think they're the people who are coming here, particularly if they're rehired as an associate professor, as in a tenured position, are going to either want the Harvard pay or they're going to want the solid benefit plan. And to try to have it both ways, it seems to me the institution is going to be in trouble.
Yeah, this came up during the University of Missouri's committee, which is similar to your committee. And what they thought would be really helpful is if they could reduce the liability on the pension side by going to defined contribution, would free up employer contributions, which are a portion of this, to be used to address the compensation issue. Compensation is a big issue across the country, certainly among publics. It was big at the University of Arizona. It's always been big here. And so the idea was that you would just sort of save money on the employer share of the pension program and move that money into salaries, which is really which is what they wanted to do. But it takes time to do that.
But that would be essentially a different model.
It would be.
It
would be a different model. I'm working on a study now on employee benefits at UC and CSU, and what's interesting, we've looked at a period 08 to 13. Employee benefits of the University of California over that period of time, have increased 94%. And why have they increased 94%? Because there's more of an employer contribution into the retirement program. I see the same trends at CSU, but not as dramatic as that. And so we're creating maybe a financial problem with what we're doing in terms of pensions. Because we're not, the one thing that's really interesting about pensions is that when you look at state budgets, you view that's a given. You don't look at that as being tradable with other things. You always assume that's a given. And when we went through, and I've been chief financial officer for a number of years, and when you go through budget reductions, three of these at Cal, you look at benefits as a possibility of trying to reduce those. They're usually never touched. You never touch benefits. You can lay people off, you can reduce the workforce, but you're not going to touch benefits. This study I'm currently doing on employee benefits is going to really highlight you've got trade-offs and you need to look at what you're going to do. So, but I thought that statistic of 94% increase in benefits versus, in the case of UC, probably a 24% increase in salary. So way, way big over that five-year period. Yes?
I have a question, a follow-up question on defined contribution plans. You've talked about the shift of responsibility to individuals, which I think is very great in defined contribution plans, as Marion was suggesting. One is that the average person is simply not educated enough to make wise investments. That's number one. Number two, I understand the advantage of putting money into salaries, but younger people with growing families are not likely to put money aside or are less likely to put money aside for retirement. And so it seems to me that there are two issues here. One is it's a huge educational challenge to turn the average employee with so many other responsibilities in life into an investor, even if all you have to do, as we have to do with 403B, is choose among various possible kinds of investments. I mean, I do my own in a very haphazard way, but I have a pension, so it's not so big a question. But the other is the whole question of equity. Is this a fair thing to do to people? It's true it's part of a large American trend to shift responsibility from institutions to individuals. Universities, public universities, have been an honorable exception to this trend. So I wondered if in your report or in your study, there was any discussion of the whole issue of how do people really learn how to invest on their own? And secondly, quite apart from the very real financial problems that the report addresses, is there an equity issue here that at least universities should be aware of, even if there isn't a lot they can do about it?
Okay, so the first part of this is that there needs to be an educational process. And what's happened, and this is true, this is probably more true at the private schools like Emory and Bryant, the two we visited. They're very concerned about where people are going to be. Are people going to be able to retire comfortably? Will they be able to retire? Yeah. So what they've done is they've worked with their defined contribution providers, which would be Fidelity, TIA, Kraft, Alec, et cetera, and they've done models for each employee. They did it at Emory to show how much you would need, what it means when you retire. So the educational process, in fact, at Emory, the concern is the comfort of their staff and faculty. They're really concerned that when people retire, they can do so with some assurance that they can meet what their obligations were. So these programs that are in place at Emory and at Bryant, and it's possible, I think they either do it at Cal or they can, provide a picture of where you're going to be So that's it's something that an individual would find difficult to do, but the these providers can do that for you using the institution. There is an equity issue, and it's really the reason I did this study was because I really care about the equity issue. I really care about whether people are going to be able to retire, whether they're going to be comfortable. And during the deliberations at UC, I was concerned about people that are in the higher echelons and people that are the regular staff. And in both Missouri and at UC, there was a very, very concern for lower paid people and how they were going to fare. Public universities do a much better job than the private sector. I have friends that are in the private sector, and they say, oh, you guys, 9-10% your funding, your pension system? We did away with that a long time ago. We have 401ks, and we just bad time to do away with it. We don't provide anything. So publics have been very generous, and they need to continue to be that way in terms of dealing with pension issues to make sure people are comfortable when they retire. The other thing is people are living longer. That's what scares me. People are living longer. So it used to be you'd live for 20 years or something after retirement. People are living a lot longer than that. Can your income survive? And see, the other part of this, Pat, that I think is important is for retirees, once you're an active employee, there's a lot of outreach. I'm not sure there's much outreach to retirees, really. And I think there needs to be more of an effort done for those folks to make sure that they're part of a university community. We have a responsibility. So,
right. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. I just wanted to comment that one of the reasons that the public institutions still have defined benefit plans is they usually a portion of their workforce is unionized.
Yes, that's right.
And the unions right. have been very careful about maintaining yep. the defined benefit plan exactly for the problem that I think the average defined contribution plan for a person in their early 50s is about 1 year's salary that they have saved. And it's a total disaster. Basically, the defined contribution plan made sure that most people in the United States are not going to retire until very late in life if they can. I've got one paper that shows that it costs about 30% more for the same benefit for a defined contribution plan, simply because as you get older and approach retirement, one has to shift one's assets into safer securities, which have a lower yield, just as your assets approach their maximum. And because of that, mm-hmm. you lose a lot of money on a defined contribution plan.
There's always a battle back and forth between the benefits of defined contribution versus defined benefits, and it goes back and forth. The problem that I see is that when you retire, the thing is that when you retire, you really want to put it into kind of a safe, you can't do a lot of risks on it. And so a lot of people put it into a safe investment strategy without an inflation adjustment. Now, there's been very low inflation, but that wasn't true of during the 80s or 90s. And so that's a danger. That's a real danger to defined contribution, is that you may end up running out of money based on how it's invested. That's why education is so important. There's a question over here.
So just to bring perhaps the discussion a little bit closer to Berkeley.
Yes. I mean,
as you know very well, we don't compete with Missouri. We don't compete with Emory, with the state of Rhode Island. We compete with Harvard, Yale, sure. and Princeton for our faculty. This is our group. So the discussion of retirement pensions is only a piece of a bigger piece, which is total remuneration. How mm-hmm. much money do people get paid, mm-hmm. and then what's their health benefits, and mm-hmm. what's their retirement. So last year, the system commissioned this study, total remuneration study, which showed that using the parameters of the 2013 minor adjustment to our retirement plan, we are already uncompetitive, mm-hmm. meaning we're below average, mm-hmm. relative to the infamous comparison 8, which I would argue are also not exactly relevant to Berkeley, but, you know, partly relevant to Berkeley. So, I mean, just taking this from the vantage point of faculty at Berkeley, what would one have to think about in terms of pensions, since this is what you've studied and you've seen elsewhere, to further strengthen our competitiveness vis-a-vis our true competitors across the country?
Yeah, what I can say about this is I'm not sure whether Emory would be a competitor. It might not be.
It is not. Can I assure you
sure.
it is not?
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. Okay, one of the things we found at private universities is their biggest concern is getting faculty to retire. Why are they not worried about that? Health benefits. They're worried about having health benefits. We have health benefits. That's really important. So privates are struggling with that whole issue of if somebody retires before Medicare age, and what happens is you've got faculty that stay in rank for a long time because they don't want to go naked without having health benefits. So I think it's important to look at total compensation, total remuneration. But I think it has to factor in all those factors. It's interestingly enough, it's not only faculty, but also administrators, senior administrators, in terms of recruiting the very best. If I'm looking at going to the University of Chicago, maybe that's not a comparable. I don't know. But I'm looking at the total, what I'm giving up here versus going there. Okay? Yes?
I'm one of the very confused people who don't get enough good information, so I'm hoping I can get it here. One thing that I remember from presentations about 5 years ago when they started increasing the contributions for the employees was that we were 73% funded. So yeah. Would you say that now we're 78 or 80?
We're about 80.
So it's getting better.
It's getting better.
Okay. You mentioned the stabilization fund, and I think that's a great idea. If we don't have it, we should, you know, lobby to start something like that. Second thing is, this summer I heard that the state of California, the legislature, agreed to put money into our plan, but they also capped the pensions at $117,000.
That's right.
And, let's see, there's other things that they're militating for. So where can we get, I mean, but I'm not even sure if that's all true. I mean,
no,
it's
true.
Okay.
It's true.
So,
what the governor, I'm sorry, finish up.
I'm wondering why the faculty haven't said anything, you know, publicly about why the Academic Senate isn't making, we don't, staff don't hear about that.
Yeah,
okay,
so
great.
I saw that. I mean, I saw the whole idea there was the University of California had asked for the state to put in the money they should have put in over that last period of time. So Governor Brown decided to do that, and that's kind of a good investment in his part because it's one-time-only money to solve this sort of problem. What he asked in exchange is a very interesting model. This only affects new hires. Doesn't affect your existing faculty. But they're moving to capping at 117, which is what they do for state employees. That's what he was going to do. But also they're introducing the concept of defined contribution. That'll be the first time, both in Cal and the CSU system you see, where they're introducing defined contribution.
Right. And they're requiring people to vote on it, as I understand. Is that?
Yeah. And again, when you make changes in pension, I've seen this over and over again, it's really a new tier of employees. It doesn't affect necessarily the existing tier or retirees, but it'll affect the new employees. But over 20 years, that becomes the population base.
Absolutely.
So people should care about that. I think the movement to having a hybrid defined benefit, defined contribution, just in my opinion, I think is a good way to go. I just think that's right.
Well, I think that's probably what's going to happen.
I think that's what's going to happen.
There's going
to be a vote. I mean, I can speak to the
Senate. So there is a task force that's working on this. It has administrators. It has members of the Senate. It's also listening to staff. And obviously one of the things is, you know, making sure there's equitable treatment of staff as well as faculty. And that task force is so far held the line on that kind of equity. I'm not on the task force, but I've gotten reports. And I would say at the moment, they don't know what they're doing, although they claim that they're going to have announcements, you know, by January. But the last reports would seem to indicate that they are still struggling with some very basic principles.
So there's been quite some discussion about the UC specifically, and I think what's interesting is that your research seems to be framed around the assumption that in most states or in most pension systems, the reforms are driven by the unfunded liability or the sense of some financial immediacy. And as we discussed here in California with UC, that actually wasn't the main driver. It was the constant drumbeat of UC's leadership asking for more money to fund UC's retirement program. But I think the interest on the part of the legislature actually, which is different than the governor, I think the legislature and the governor here in California have different approaches to their sense of risk and responsibilities on the part of retirement plans. The legislature has a very strong commitment to defined benefit plans. The legislature's interest was really borne by the fact that UC has had a number of exec compensation splashes in the newspapers. Whether it's bonuses or whether it's just the primary salary. Some of those figures, I think, were just hard for the legislature to stomach. Given that that was part of the interest, I'm curious if in the reforms that you've seen, there's been any tiering to sort of address the fact that, a 5% match, or I think in some cases you mentioned maybe as high as a 10% match on the part of the employer, is different, obviously, for a salary of someone earning $1 million versus someone earning 125, just right above the cap. So I was wondering if you can talk if there's been that kind of equity lens in some of the reforms.
Okay. In the states we looked at, and we looked at three other states, that's not been as big an issue as it is in California. I'm real familiar with California. I came in 91. It's always been a conversation there. It's always been a conversation of equity. It's always been a conversation of UC is overcompensating its executive staff, et cetera. I think the fact, if you considered UC to be a state agency, probably legitimate, but it's not a state agency. Never has been a state agency. It's constitutionally autonomous. Its competition is other major research universities, and the talent that university competes with is with those other universities. So in the employee benefit study I'm looking at now with UC, I have drawn a group of private universities, which would be Harvard, Yale, Princeton, et cetera. And their composition is really different than other public universities. And so I think the issue that's always a recurring issue is, why should the University of California be treated differently? Why should the University of California behave differently than other state agencies? Shouldn't we do some kind of a change that would normalize this more? And I think the danger is you may normalize to a point where you reduce the quality and the ability of the university to compete with other institutions in the country and the world. That's the concern.
Number of departments, right? I mean, I think that if you look at most, or I'm not sure, but I guess my presumption would be in most departments within a university, you're not getting at the $1 million salaries. Most of those are probably in the med schools, right?
Yeah, when we looked at, well, it depends. When I was in Arizona, I was there for a couple of years, we looked at the faculty salary data. And you're right, there's a real difference between humanities, social sciences, engineering, business, et cetera. And so, but in the case of the University of Arizona, which is AAU, it's a quality institution, the big gaps were in that area. Okay, but the higher salaries would be in engineering. They would certainly be in health sciences. And so when you're doing comparisons, you really need to exclude that group of folks. But UC has not got a medical center or health sciences. It basically has, the programs that are associated with a non-health science. It's not like UCLA. So when Berkeley compares itself to other universities, it needs to choose universities that are very comparable to it, that don't have the medical center. But the issue is can UC stay competitive, and is there a value for UC being competitive within the state of California? I think there is, but there's a different opinion.
We have time for one more question.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.